Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. This week, we begin a special series of conversations with migrants who have made an impact in their new homes. Now, I've been lucky enough to talk with people who have made impacts before, but for the most part, that's been by chance or happenstance or evolution. And, of course, if you want to get metaphysical, every person makes an impact everywhere they go. It's got to do with things like chi, life force, energy waves, string theory, all that stuff. So I acknowledge that. But for the next 3 weeks, I'm presenting conversations that I've had with people who've taken it upon themselves to not only make an impact in the place where they've migrated to, they've tried to change the game. These are people who, when faced with a need to adapt to a new culture that they've landed in, have decided that they would see if they couldn't help the culture adapt ever so slightly to them. These are all exciting interviews to be a part of, and each of them has inspired me to be more conscious about the choices that I make when I do things like try to organize a community, or even start a business. Yes, I need to be mindful of where I am and make plans based on existing cultural norms and practices, but I also shouldn't be afraid to try injecting a little bit of myself into the culture while I'm at it. I hope that you enjoy these conversations. I think that they highlight one of the greatest benefits that migration brings to all of us, a constant cultural evolution and rejuvenation. Alex Scher didn't choose the expat life. His parents brought him from his native New York to Hong Kong while he was in high school, but he's taken to life as a foreigner with gusto. After graduation, he spent a gap year in Beijing learning Chinese and just never left. A year of college prep was followed by enrollment in Peking University's prestigious international relations program, where he founded the Western Student Union. But beneath the academic success, he scored a B in Marxist theory and English. And his globetrotting is something that is unusual to most of us, but is becoming much more common. A different sense of where home might be than what many of us would expect. If you leave your country of origin at 14, camp out in another country with your parents until the end of high school, then move to another country for college while your parents move to another city that you have no connection to, how can you ever feel at home? It's something that might sound frightening to most. It feels like something vital would be lacking. And while it might be true from a certain perspective, there are benefits, such as an unlimited horizon of possibilities. If you're not attached to a particular place, then there's nothing to prevent you from going anywhere. It was a lot of fun chatting with Alex, and I think you're going to like him just as much as I do. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Alex Scher. Alex Scher, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you very much.
Where is home?
Oh boy. Do you want the long answer or the short answer?
Oh, this is a podcast. We go as long as you want, baby.
Oh no. All right. Well, I'll try to give you the short and sweet, but lengthened for fun and games. So I'm from New York City, but...
That's one strike against you.
moved to Hong Kong in 2007, and then moved to Beijing in 2010, shortly after graduation from high school in Hong Kong. Then I've been living in Beijing for about 9 years now.
Okay. So, yeah. So where among those places is there a place that you identify as home?
Right. So actually, no, I was thinking about this on the way here. It's a very interesting question. I mean, for many of us, but for me in particular, my parents relocated to Suzhou, Jiangsu, about 4 years ago now. So
are your parents Chinese?
They are not.
You don't look it.
I didn't want to assume. Well, no, so they moved there about 4 years ago now. And it's strange for me to go home, quote unquote, to my parents' house, which is in a city that I really have no connection to. I think home for me is really Beijing. You know, it's the city that I feel most comfortable in. My friends are here. Well, as we talked about before, slowly leaving one by one.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Right. But, you know, New York is a home from what seems like a lifetime ago. You know, I go back to visit. And, I mean, I know my way around the city, but a lot has changed as well. You know, I don't know where the cool restaurants and bars and stuff are. You know, some things that I, you know, some shops that I took for granted when I lived there, I've, you know, moved. So.
Yeah. It's tough. I've had my trips back to Boston and it's just this weird thing where it's like, oh, I'm home in quotation marks. And then after a day or two, you're kind of like, but I don't recognize that. And this getting over here feels a little bit different now. And it's this weird home, but not home feeling. It's right. Like a past life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what took you, like, what's a nice boy from New York City? Where in New York City?
Upper East Side.
Upper East Side. Yeah. Whoa, yeah. Snooty. Yeah. So I'm just going to aside here. One of my good friends who's been on the show, Virginia Johnson, she moved to New York after school in Boston. She got a job. She went to law school and then got a job at a law firm there. And there was one point where she actually had an apartment on the East Side in a deluxe apartment in the sky. And I used to say to her, once you've achieved sitcom theme song status, what else is there in life? I mean, she had like on this, like the 50th floor of like this tower on the East Side.
And awesome.
I was like, my God, where do we go from here? And she was like 24. It's like, whatever. But yeah, so what takes a guy from the Upper East Side to Hong Kong and then Beijing?
Right. So it was my mom's job that took us from New York to Hong Kong. There was a period of a couple months.
So your parents are the expats.
Right.
I don't know this about you. So this is interesting. So you get brought over with the parents to Hong Kong.
Right. So okay. I was just about to say that, like, just before we moved, there was an interesting period of a few months, but really sort of the main deal of the action happened in the last month. I was graduating from ninth grade. My school went from kindergarten to ninth grade. And so, you know, I had to move on. I had to move somewhere.
That's an interesting structure. In the U.S., usually we have ninth grade as part of the high school.
But, right. So this was actually so that kids that wanted to go to boarding school spent 1 year, you know, less at boarding school. Oh. So their parents would get to, you know, have them for one more year. And then they kind of skip the hazing or, you know, whatever happens.
Sure.
That first year of boarding school. So I was looking at some schools in Brooklyn and also Hong Kong. So in the last month, you know, it all kind of came together. Parents sold the apartment, moved all of our stuff to Hong Kong, as we eventually decided. So it was, yeah.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
No.
So it's just you.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. So you didn't start the expat life on your own. Like, this wasn't an affirmative decision for you.
Right. Yeah. But I was really, really excited about it. You know, not having any brothers and sisters to influence, you know, me by, you know, whining, saying they don't want to leave their friends, stuff like that. And, you know, it was a time of transition for me anyway. So, you know, I knew I wasn't going to be with my friends from school anyway.
You were either going to go to boarding school or go to Hong Kong. So.
Right. From Manhattan to Brooklyn or Manhattan to Hong Kong. It's just a few extra miles, you know.
Spoken like a true Manhattanite. Wow. So, what do your parents do that your mom brought you over to Hong Kong?
Right. So my mom's in the luggage industry, and a lot of the
makes sense to be in a travel hub, I guess.
Yeah, sure. And also the manufacturing is, or a lot of it's done in southern China. Mm. So the proximity to southern China from Hong Kong obviously was a big factor, but also just. I mean, 2007, Guangdong didn't really seem like, you know, a place that we wanted to live. So we settled on Hong Kong.
As someone who was there in the early aughts, I can tell you, yes, it was not a place you wanted to live.
Right. So anyway, we settled in Hong Kong. I had a fantastic 3 years there at high school, graduated from Hong Kong International School, and then wanted to take a gap year. And the way I remember it is that there had to be some sort of compromise. Like I really wanted to travel for my gap year and go see, you know, awesome places in Asia. But my parents also wanted me to do something productive. So I came back to them with this plan. Hey, I'm going to go live in Beijing. I'm going to learn Chinese and I'm going to travel around China for my gap year and then kind of sort it out, you know, sort out school after that gap year. The way they tell the story is our son came to us and was like, I want to learn Mandarin. And they were bowled over and more than happy to, you know, sign anywhere needed when your son comes and says he wants to study Mandarin on his own will. So, moved to Beijing summer 2010, started quote unquote studying at Beijing Language and Culture University shortly thereafter.
Is that in Wudakko?
It is. Okay. It is, yeah. And then I did a semester there, a semester at Tsinghua, some private tutoring, some classes at Global Village School, and then got into Peking University's Yukoban, which is the college prep program. So it's basically a very intensive year-long language program. And then if you...
That preps you for university?
Right, essentially. So there were about 140 Koreans, a smattering of Mongolians, Thais, Japanese, Malaysians, Indonesians, and there were two Westerners.
Wow.
There was a Belarusian kid and the American.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You kind of saw if you live in Beijing, you would think that there are no Japanese or Koreans here because they all basically live in one part of town and you just never see them. If you're up at university, you would see that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You see that dynamic in the population. Like the number one population of foreigners in Beijing, I believe, is Koreans.
Yeah.
And Japanese is pretty close.
Right, sure.
Yeah. So, but you see that at university. It's fascinating.
And you see all sides of the Korean lifestyle, you know, stumbling and drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning or singing karaoke with the paper thin walls in the dorm. Oh, man. Anyway. An experience. It was a lot of fun.
Then you did 4 years at Peking University.
I did, yeah.
And what did you study?
I studied international relations.
As one does. Is that mostly taught in Chinese?
Yeah, all the courses were in Chinese, except for my mandatory English class that I had to take.
How did you do in that class? Please tell me you failed.
You know, I didn't fail, but I didn't do as well as one might hope. The professor, also an American, you know, long-term expat, been living in China for 20-something years.
He went hard on you because you're an American?
Well, he felt that, you know, you were born into, you know, an English-speaking family. It's your native tongue. It's not fair that I give you a 95 because you were born with it when these other Chinese kids are working so hard for their grades. So he gave me an 84.
Wow. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking, you know, flippantly, I'm like, oh, geez, you know, how could you fail that? But two things I'll say. One, I went to a Catholic high school after 8 years of Catholic school, and I failed freshman religion. Because the Catholic school I went to was pretty much just standard indoctrination. It's just, this is Catholicism, it's the catechism, you're going to hell, all that stuff. And then I went to a Jesuit high school, and the Jesuits are basically the hippies of Catholicism. And, you know, the current Pope is a Jesuit, you know, he's super left wing for Catholics, right? And I get to high school, and my freshman year religion teacher, I remember one day he actually came in and he said, God is not real. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, because they take a very intellectual, holistic approach towards religious education. You learn about the history of religion. You know, we learned about how rosary is really stolen from Hinduism and prayer beads and all this stuff. So anyways, so it kind of makes sense that you could go into an English class and not actually do well, because one of my previous girlfriends is a Russian woman, and she is an English teacher. And she would ask me, hey, is this the proper tense and the declination of the verb? And I'm like, what should I know?
Yeah.
I just know if it's right. I'm a professional editor. Like, I edit for a living and I don't know the rules. I just know if it's right.
Sure.
And so I could totally go into an English class and not do well.
Right.
Like, I would score a B. I'd be a solid B student.
Well, I mean, it was just a little scary that, you know, I got an 83 in Maoist thought. So, I mean...
You're just as good in Maoist thought as you are in English.
You know, well, there's a 1 point difference, but
so let me. I'm curious about this because, see, I didn't know this about you. You came over before high school as the trailing kid, and that was your introduction to living overseas. And it kind of makes sense that you would choose to live overseas. Did you ever think you wanted to go back to New York? Was there ever the thought process like, geez, I've been over here in Hong Kong, I miss being back in New York?
Not really.
No. So it was always just, where's next? Never really. It was never about, can I go back? It was always about, where's next?
I mean, I'm not really too sure if my parents know this, but, I didn't really work that hard on my, you know, applications, my college applications during my gap year, because I wasn't really interested in going back to the States.
Was that kind of the assumption that you would go back to like UNC or something or whatever?
I mean, you know, I had toured a couple universities during my, what was it, junior summer. So going into senior year in high school. And actually, I was going to, you know, apply to Northeastern and I think Boston University and, you know, a couple other schools stateside. But also...
With all the other kids from China.
Right. Fair. I was also very interested in applying to universities, like American universities outside of the US. So, you know, American University in Paris, American University in Cairo. There was one school in the UK that I also applied to. I just thought it would be interesting to study international relations outside the US.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that there might be a sort of tinge of the American exceptionalism, you know, feeling, studying in the US.
It's interesting because you know, your formative years were outside the US. Granted, it's an IB school, this Hong Kong International School, right?
Not IB, it was AP.
AP. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. Oh, you did the AP program.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had a basically American program.
Yeah, sure.
In an international setting, and you kind of wanted to stick with that. It was interesting that you had that perspective. I actually like to think from the teacher perspective, because my wife is a teacher, so I see it from that side.
Sure.
From the teacher's side, I think that American, you know, Western trained teachers should basically go do a couple of years overseas, make some real money, but like get their experience overseas. I met a guy once, and it's all about that perspective, the international perspective. If you could somehow do that international perspective with the students, as well with the teachers, I really feel like that would enliven the education of everybody. But I remember I met this guy once. He had taught in South Central LA for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then he came over to Beijing to teach at one of the top flight international schools here. And he just shook his head and he's like, I can't believe I didn't do this before. He's like, I was paying for supplies out of my pocket, these schools, and over here, these schools just have everything. Mm-hmm. And if the kids could somehow experience that for a year or two or 3 years, like you did, and understand kind of the, not only the resources that should be made, but also just the different perspective that you get. Like you said, the American exceptionalism creeping in. That says a lot to me about you recognizing that, okay, there's more to education. There's more to the perspective than that. That's valid. It's fine. It's where I'm from, but there's more to it than that. And I need the more.
Right.
And it's something that our students don't get.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You chose to do your 4 years university in Beijing.
Right.
What made you want to do that as opposed to going to Cairo or London or wherever?
Right. I think it was just kind of how the cookie crumbled in the end. You know, I had already done 2 years of language study, and then had a chance to do this college prep program at Peking University. Didn't know if I was going to get into the undergrad program after that year. You know, I heard it was super, super competitive.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So after, you know, hearing that I think 180 kids, you know, were signed up and that only 70 of us would get in. It was terrifying.
Yeah.
But figured, heck, might as well go for it, have a stab at it, and if it doesn't work out, well, then I can always go back to the States, or you know, I'm just a few years behind everybody else. Yeah. So,
you were at university, didn't you? Organize? Were you like the head of the Peking University Foreign Students Association or something like that?
So yeah, the Western Students Union, actually.
That's like community organizing.
Oh, Mei Xue Sheng Hui.
Yeah.
So.
Jiao.
So that was, you know, maybe not the choicest in terms of name, but we were trying to have a very wide umbrella because we didn't have so many Americans that we could just form the American Students Union or something like that. But anyway, we recognized that there was a need for a student union like this because it's generally the Western kids that come in and there's no support system for them. So you have the Korean students who have their own clubs, the Korean Student Association, you have the Japanese Student Association.
There's a lot more of them too.
Yeah, there's a lot more of them. I mean, some of them have been living in China for 10, 15 years. They've gone to high school here. Their parents live here. Parents, like, you know, I kind of think of the parents, like, bringing, like, a plate of oranges, you know, to, the, like, the events and stuff like that. I don't know if it happens. But just, you know, they have that support system. And for the Western students who maybe have never been to China or been to China only once before, arrive in a foreign country and the university is of no help in even securing, you know, a place to live or helping get a SIM card or your Wi-Fi set up or, you know, taking you around the area, helping you sign up for classes, even in some respects, finding student clubs, you know, all of these things. So anyway, we decided to found the Western Students Union to, you know, act as that sort of support net for these incoming students.
This is a broad question, but I'm thinking of you as a Western student at this Chinese university.
Right.
A lot of them in America, in the West especially, we have this image of the Chinese students coming over. Mm-hmm. There's 500,000 in America right now.
Sure.
And my feeling is they're not really prepared very well. And what you're saying to me echoes so much what you hear about on the American side with the Chinese students.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what, as the foreign student, as the Western student at Peking University, you're with the elites of the Chinese educational system, and it's super competitive to get in there.
Right.
What is that experience like? Do you find that the students and the faculty are open to having you there? Do you feel like there's a begrudging acceptance? Do you feel welcome? Like what is that feeling like?
Right. Generally, everyone is welcoming and helpful. You know, a lot of kids didn't really go out of their way to make sure that everything was okay and, you know, that I was finding my classes okay and stuff like that. But if I made an effort to approach generally anyone on campus, they were pretty helpful. I think a lot of people just thought that I was there for a semester or just there to study language. And I think the feeling was, this kid has shown up in our Marxism class, you know, for the last 6 weeks. He's really lost.
You know? Does he know what we're even talking about
yeah,
here?
Yeah. Like, why does he just sit in the corner and just, there's no way he can understand this. To some degree, they're right. I mean, heck, it was really tough, but,
yeah, Marxism's pretty complicated.
Yeah. Or, you know, comparative politics or, you know, history of diplomacy or whatever, you know, whatever it might be. But, you know, for the core classes for international relations, you had, a number of international students actually that were sitting in the class, but sort of for some of the electives and stuff like that, you would have fewer foreigners. So that was when, you know, people were sort of interested in why you were there. But I don't think there was really a sense of they weren't not welcoming, but maybe slight resentment in the sense that they thought that the teachers would be more lenient on us in terms of grades. Sometimes was the case, sometimes was not the case at all, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I'd imagine you probably get a few that let a few things slide, but then a few that are extra hard. So in the balance, it probably all evens out.
Right. I mean, so generally a positive experience. Wouldn't say that anyone was out to get me. Yeah, I had a great experience at Peking University. Actually, you know, I should mention that one of the highlights of my time there was really meeting all of the other international students and getting to form strong bonds with them over my 4 years there. Our student dormitory, or the dorm that I lived in, was just, I mean, we must have had 80 or 100 different nationalities in there. Just on my floor, you know, everyone from Korean, you know, Koreans, French. We had some kids from the Netherlands. We had North Koreans. We had Singaporeans.
North Koreans. Wow. Yeah, actually, that makes sense. That'd be one of the few areas where Westerners and North Koreans could actually interact.
Right. Yeah. That was fascinating.
They must have done really well in Marxist theory.
One would hope. But I had a good buddy from Tonga, actually, who lived across from a North Korean student. And turns out that, or I heard, that this student was the son of the ambassador to China from North Korea. And we ended up going out to dinner one night and had, you know, a couple drinks. And by the end of the night, I mean, it was a lot of hugs and, you know, we had a fantastic time together.
It's so, one of those, you know, I learned that my experience with the Russian culture learning it was very much like that. You know, the Russian people, you get that they're very standoffish. They don't smile. They're not laughing a lot. But you get that few shots of vodka into them, or the Mitavuka, or whatever they're drinking. You get that into them, and then next thing you know, they're all slapping each other's backs. And
right,
it kind of makes you wonder if the reason that, like, hard alcohol, like, you know, rice wine in Japan and China and, you know, whatever drink in Korea, you wonder if that's so prevalent because everyone needs it to get past that stony exterior.
Maybe,
It's a social lubricant as vital as petroleum.
Oh, I mean, absolutely is a social lubricant, that's for sure.
Now, I want to ask you about something that happened a few years ago. You got interviewed and some of your sound bites got shanghaied. This was the time when the dear leader in China was, there was a move to remove his term limits. And your face showed up in a propaganda video for him. And I'm just curious as to, like, what the reaction was. Now, I'm not looking for you to denounce anything, right? That's not why I'm asking. I'm asking because you're a foreigner in a country and you find yourself kind of in this situation where you are, you know, for however it happens or for whatever reason, you become part of the background milieu of whatever is happening in the body politic and the media ephemera that's surrounding that. And, like, what is that, like, what does that make you think about the place where you've decided to live? Do you feel like, oh, that's great that I'm seen as important? Or do you feel like, man, that's creepy? Or do you just feel like, does that just blow your mind?
It's more, I guess, frustration. it's funny that was a, you know, now we talk about it as a propaganda video, but, you know, at the time it was just, hey, you know, these things happen very, very casually at Peking University. It's they have foreigners that, well, they have, you know, a whole sort of range of foreigners from all these different countries that they can choose from. You know, some speak Chinese, some they want to do interviews in Chinese, some they want to do in English, some they want to do in their local language. And as the president of the Western Students Union at the time, I was constantly getting requests to do, you know, interviews or game shows or, you know, whatever it might be.
Oh, yeah.
And it
was also the white face can go on the shows. And
sure.
Be like,
yeah. And, but it was also, I saw it as a way to sort of curry favor with the International Students Department, with my teachers, with whoever was asking me to do these things, because it would make them look good. Hopefully then they would help me out, you know, further down the road. So I was approached about this video just as, hey, someone from some news organization, I don't think it was even specified in the WeChat message, wants to interview you. I was like, great, okay. You know, I'm free at this time. Let's do it. So then they show up and I find out that they're from People's Daily. I'm like, oh, well, fantastic.
Just state-run news organ.
Right. You know, but it was a video interview. And so I was like, you know, how bad could it be? Hopefully they won't, you know, edit, you know, my words too harshly, something like that. So,
and you've got experience. I mean, you know how to give answers that are not offensive and are revelatory, but not incisive. And
right. But yeah. I mean, I think also it was a bit of a shame. You know, I just got my interview got lumped with, you know, a whole bunch of other kids that were probably much less suspecting than I was. I mean, it was a funny video to watch in the end. And I just wasn't too happy that I was a part of it, but
I've had a very limited experience in that type of thing. You obviously were more high profile than I'm just a regular guy was, but I did a couple of these trips and I think I've mentioned something that happened on one of them a couple of times, but I call them rent-a-lawai trips. These are the ones where you go on these quote business trips and they take you to some convention or some big professional, like a exposition,
yeah, sure,
or an industry event.
Yeah.
And they parade you around as the group of foreign investors who are going to go to these things. And I did a few of these and some of them you get paid for, but some of them, usually you only get paid if you're going to do a speaking gig.
Right.
You're going to go up and give this policy speech and you're the representative of whatever organization that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I never did that, but I remember this one trip I went on a few of them. They were fun. We just got free trips, you know?
Yeah.
One of the trips I went on, we got used as props in some propaganda big time. Like we got put in, you know, we did the standard walk through the event. Then we got brought in for a sit down with the governor of the province. And it was all being filmed. It was in one of the rooms where they have the diplomats and the two big chairs and the chairs and rows alongside, you know? And I was sitting, I was sitting on the seat closest to the governor. on the side, like not next to him, because we had the ambassador from some small country who had nothing to do that weekend, and they probably gave him some money. So he came out for this thing. And I'm sitting in the seat just off to the side of the governor, and I know that I'm on TV because they got the cameras panning, and right. You know, and I'm in the shot, wide shot, and I'm just thinking, I am just this white face prop that they've put here. Like, this is so crazy. And then they bring us in for this, quote, signing ceremony, where there's a bunch of contracts that are being signed with these foreign investors and the companies that are involved in the expo. And they literally picked out three of us foreigners and said, okay, who wants to be the one that signs the thing? And one guy said, I'll do it. And you know, he was better looking than me, which is not difficult. So they bring him over and they sign the thing. And I'm just like, wow, this is so crazy. Then we have a luncheon.
Yeah.
And they've trot out the vice governor, like the vice minister or the vice premier of the province. And it's, he goes through this elaborate thing where he does a toast to every single one of us and does a ganbei. And there's 20 of us in this huge round table, and it's a full state dinner. Like, oh, state dinner. I mean, it's a full formal. They got the wait staff, five courses, the drinks. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? It's so surreal.
Right.
And you meet these people and you get trotted around and you realize that you, oh, and then there was the concert that they organized for us. There was this big concert that was on state TV, and they brought us in and, you know, they marched us in, and everyone cheered us as we came in and sat down in the middle, and the 3-hour gala that they broadcast on state TV, and we're there. It's like, oh my God. So it's just so surreal to be a part of that. And you know, none of it is about you personally.
Right.
No one gives a crap who you are or what your name is or, you know, and they don't want to get to know you. They just are excited that you're there and that you can be used as this validating thing.
Yeah.
And that interview you did, or the splice of the interview you did that got put into that video is kind of like that, but much more high profile.
It was. Yeah. But I mean, you know, again, I just got interviewed, few weeks ago I was up in Chengdu for a hockey tournament, and I was the only foreigner there. I was just playing with some Chinese teammates of mine, and they interviewed me, you know, how many times you've been to Chengdu, and is this your first time playing hockey here?
This is local media.
Yeah, local media. Yeah, it's like the Chengdu People's, you know, daily or something like that. But, you know, I read the article after it came out, and she had not used a single phrase even that I had told her. She basically just used my name, age, you know, where I was from, and then completely just wrote her own narrative. So I messaged her on WeChat. I was like, you know, next time you don't even need to interview me. You can just, you know, you can just use my info. It's all here on WeChat, and just, yeah, go for it. And I mean, of course she was embarrassed, but you know, you have these two sort of two different narratives or
this
two different objectives.
Yeah, it's two different, like,
clashing, you know?
Yeah, there's like two different demands that are trying to be met. There's one which is like we got to get the, you know, we got to have something that's information that's out there. It's interesting. It's, it is news that's happening. But the other side is what is the message of the day?
And
what do we need to weave into that so that it feeds into our overall narrative?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that's why I guess it's a bit frustrating. And, you know, moving forward, unless that changes, you know, I think I might be more hesitant to get involved with anything regarding state media.
You've learned your lesson.
I have.
Yeah. I probably won't go on those rent a Lawai trips anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I did go on one of those too a few years ago. Actually, this was it was to Xining, Qinghai province.
That's where I went. I went to Xining.
Oh, great.
Well, they don't need the foreigners and the coastal cities anymore. All these trips are to the interior where there are no foreigners.
Well, you know, but I was actually fascinated by this trip because this was right after Xi's announcement of the Belt and Road initiative. So we went to this massive, massive expo at this brand new convention center outside Xining. And there were probably 2,000 to 3,000 in the press corps, sort of down below us. And we were on stage, balloons being let up into the air, ribbons being cut, loud music. We're just there waving on stage to all these thousands of people. It was really nuts. But I mean, for me, the expo was really interesting because this is what sort of one of the first looks into the Belt and Road and you know, what they were sort of expecting or hoping it was going to be. And yeah, so
it's really, it gives us a really interesting perspective as the outsiders who they definitely want us there.
Yeah.
But they only want us there to a certain extent.
Right. Yeah.
And for certain purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really interesting. So you've graduated. You graduated from Peking University, and
I did by the skin of my teeth.
By the skin of your teeth. One of the things I've noticed about you, this is actually just from your WeChat feed, because we only hang out a couple times a year. We've met with some events that we've been participants in, and you travel quite a lot. So I'm going to guess, I'm going to suppose that a lot of that travel comes from the fact that you knew people from school who are everywhere. So you're going to places where you've either heard of or you can visit people, and that just, you're just able to travel because you have a little bit of access.
Absolutely.
Did you go to Tajikistan?
I did.
And yeah. You were up in like the mountains in like the middle of nowhere, right?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Were you playing hockey on the frozen lakes?
Not in Tajikistan, but,
how many of the stands have you been to?
So I've been to Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and I'll be going to Turkmenistan for a hockey tournament this October holiday.
Well, there you go.
So yeah.
That's great, man.
Missing Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Those are tough to do. Although I hear you can kind of go out to like Xinjiang and like just stroll across the border and come back and say you were there.
Really?
Yeah. I know someone who's done it. Like it's a little dicey and they may come out after you with a Jeep, but you can just like, I didn't know where I was. And yeah.
Well, I mean, that's for another discussion. I'm very interested to hear more. I'll tell you that.
What's so funny is how you got this smirk and a little light in your eye went off. Like, oh, I got to do that. I got to learn more. But that's the life of someone
I'd be interested to. But you know, back to your point, yeah, I had classmates from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, Tajikistan, other stands. And it was fantastic, you know, super, super, super hospitable. Maybe never in a million years thought that their American classmate would take the time and make the effort to go visit them. So I visited classmates in Armenia, Turkey, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and then, yeah, Tajikistan. So I like, for example, a few years ago, I spent Chinese New Year with my Kazakh classmate in her house in Almaty. And she's actually ethnically Chinese. Her parents moved to Kazakhstan about 30 years ago.
Wow.
So we were having a full Chinese New Year dinner spread, watching the Spring Festival gala on TV.
In Kazakhstan.
And it was just awesome. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almaty is a pretty happening place, I hear these days, kind of booming, a lot of petrodollars going
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you've stayed in China, which makes sense because you spent so much time learning Chinese and learning in Chinese. Do you find yourself, I mean, you travel a lot. Do you find yourself wanting to stay in China, or do you feel like this is kind of where you, I don't want to say have to be, but do you feel like because you had a Chinese university education that your best opportunities are here?
Right. I think it's a combination of the two at the moment. I see the best opportunities for me are probably here in China. Also, thanks to the network that I've built over the last nine years in the mainland. But also, it's just an exciting place to be, exciting place to live. I really enjoy traveling in China still, except for at holiday season. But I have a few places to go, you know, on my bucket list, and then I'll start getting into the more off the beaten track and get progressively weirder.
Yeah,
you know.
Do you think about, for the foreseeable future, you staying in China, or do you find yourself with a desire? Because basically what I'm trying to get at is kind of this, you moved overseas with your parents in your formative years. So yeah. Like, it's pretty understood that you basically were a third culture kid for the last several years of your kid life.
Sure.
And now you've studied overseas and you travel a lot overseas. I know you travel overseas more than you travel to the US.
Yeah.
So do you think about where your future path lies in terms of how long you want to stay in China, how long you want to stay overseas? Do you want to take your experience back to the US eventually? Like, what's that kind of thought process?
Right. I think moving to Hong Kong or something like that to start a family life eventually. US is also for sure an option. For the foreseeable future, though, I think I'm going to be China based.
Yeah.
As we were talking, you know, earlier, I told you that I was going to be moving to Shanghai in a few months. So we'll see where that takes me. I'll probably be there for a couple years, at least I can imagine, and then, reevaluate.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, Hong Kong, you need to be financially in a good place financially.
You know, it's no fooling down there. You got to have the resources. Getting in the door is tough.
Absolutely. And then also, I guess, finding a job back in the US that would be fulfilling to me in all respects.
I mean, could you work anywhere but like the Council of Foreign Relations? I mean, you know, like where could you possibly work with your skill set?
You know,
I guess finance, anyone's doing business in China.
Hopefully you can work in a lot of different places, but you know, it's just a matter of, you know, finding a place that really fits. And
so you've got this permanent itch now of like internationalism and travel and
yeah. I mean, I think that's something else too, where, you know, once you coming off, the last, you know, few years of just sort of incessant travel and stuff like that, maybe there will be a point 5 to 10 years from now where I feel like slowing down. But, you know, even my managers right now are just constantly traveling, you know, all over China, back and forth to the US, to London, to Singapore, Tokyo. And I mean, so it's either you want a travel heavy job or you want a job where you're, you know, so closer to home, most of the time.
It's the nature of the global economy.
Right.
Everyone's got to be able to operate everywhere.
Yeah.
And you're set up to do that.
Right. So I think that's kind of what I'm leaning towards, at least for the next few years. I really enjoy traveling. So yeah, whether I'm in China or in the US, a job that can afford me some travel to China and travel in China would be fantastic.
Well, Alex, sir, I appreciate you taking time out of your busy travel schedule. I'm sure you have a flight to catch. I appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike, for having me.
Well, there you have it. Thanks again to Alex for coming in and chatting with me. I really appreciate it. I just love having my worldview challenged. We've got a couple more of these interviews before we hit our season finale, so stick with us. You're really going to enjoy the conversations that are coming up. As always, you can reach out with any comments or questions or interview suggestions you might have. I'm looking for more people to talk to. You can find me on Twitter at ZAX2000. And of course, email is mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.